Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. Born and raised in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Joseph P. Farrell has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford and pursues research in physics, alternative history, and science, and strange stuff. His book, The Giza Death Star, was published in the spring of 2002 and was his first venture into alternative history and science, following a paradigm of researching the relationship between alternative history and science. Farrell has followed with a stunning series of books, each conceived to stand alone, but each also conceived in a pre-arranged sequence. The book we will be discussing today is The Cosmic War, Interplanetary Warfare, Modern Physics, and Ancient Texts, and we'll also be talking about aspects of his Giza Death Star trilogy. So, without any further ado, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thanks for having me on, James. My apologies about the previous schedule to you and your listeners. I was writing a book, and I just lost all sense of time, so it's entirely my fault.
No worries. These time zone differences does my head in. Now, for the benefit of our listeners, Doctor, there is a paleo, as you term it, a paleo ancient science that's involved. And I feel the listeners need a background before we delve into the who, what, and the where. Could you tell us what is meant by Bode's Law? Because there is a large asteroid belt in our solar system, which actually defies explanation for those who are too mentally rigid to wrap their mind around it. But it ties into Dr. Tom Van Flandern's exploded planet hypothesis. Can you elaborate on that?
The case in point here is Dr. Van Flandern himself, as you mentioned, because Van Flandern was the U.S. Naval Observatory chief astronomer for many, many years. He was, he was a kind of a mainstream astronomer. And he revived, effectively, in my opinion, he revived an old theory that astronomers had held in the very late 18th and early 19th centuries, because they were using an astronomical law that was developed by two German astronomers. The law is called the Titius-Bode law. And they discovered that the orbits of the planets in our solar system around the sun occur at kind of a regular arithmetic projection from the sun. And so on the basis of this law, they hypothesized that there should be a planet orbiting in the asteroid belt. And of course, when they started looking, they didn't find any planet. but what they did find was, of course, a bunch of small little planetoids and rocks and, you know, the asteroid belt. So on the basis of their law, and having discovered a few of the larger asteroids, they hypothesized that there had been a planet in that orbit, but that it had blown up. And in fact, here's the kicker, James. They called that planet Krypton. We're constantly confronted by the fact that somebody in the popular culture, you know, the creator of the Superman mythology and the comic books and so on, was following the scientific theories pretty closely. Well, Van Flandern kind of revived that hypothesis, the exploded planet hypothesis, and he began to ask some questions. Well, you know, if a planet was in the asteroid belt and it suddenly blew up, might that account for the orbits of comets? So he used a computer program and programmed in the orbits of various comets and so on, and then ran the program backward to see if there was a common point of origin in the asteroid belt sometime in the past. And lo and behold, two dates jumped out when he did that. And one date was about 65 million years ago, which is an interesting date that we'll get back to. And the other date was much more recent, and it was about 3.2 million years ago. But the 65 million years ago date was interesting to him because that's the date, more or less, that many scientists think was the date that an asteroid slammed into the Earth and caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. And that, an asteroid slamming into the Earth could certainly result if you're blowing up a planet. But the problem for Van Flandern, and this is where it really gets, to my mind, it started to get very interesting. When you read his book, Dark Matter, Missing Planets, and New Comets is the title of the book. And it's a very interesting read. It's full of lots of scientific details and information, but it's written kind of like a detective novel at the same time. And you start to read it, and when Van Flandern starts to talk about, why did the planet blow up? That's when it gets interesting, because he proposes a number of mechanisms for why this planet would have exploded. And the first method that he proposes is that it had a natural fission reactor in the core of the planet, and such things do occur. There have been evidences from Africa that there are these kind of natural atomic piles that occurred in nature that burnt out long ago, but there's certainly evidence to suggest that these kinds of phenomena can occur. The problem, though, that he had, and he knew it almost as immediately as he proposed the idea, is that a fission reaction, is kind of a low energy sort of atomic reaction. It's the difference between an A bomb and an H bomb. An H bomb is much more powerful than the lowly atomic bomb. So he kind of ditched that idea, and then he proposed the next mechanism that he proposed was that, okay, there may have been a bunch of antimatter that was self-contained somehow, please note the word somehow, in the core of the planet, and then somehow that containment broke down, the antimatter came into contact with matter, you had a total annihilation reaction, and kablooey, the planet blew up. But again, there's a problem, because if you study contemporary physics, there is much less naturally occurring antimatter in the universe than matter. That's called the matter-antimatter anisotropy. And it's a good thing too, because if there were equal amounts of it, you may have planets blowing up all over the place, when matter comes into contact with antimatter. So it's not a phenomenon that would be very probable. So the next thing he said, you can kind of sense as he's proposing all these models, you can kind of sense that his frustration is growing. So the next thing he says, and this is James, where I sat up in my chair and took real notice. The next mechanism he proposes is, well, it may have been a very sophisticated technology that had an accidental breakdown. So, in other words, he was proposing that this missing planet, number one, was inhabited. Number two, whoever was on it was, possessed of high intelligence. Number three, had a sophisticated technology. Number four, that it suffered an accident. Number five, the planet blew up. And, that this is hitting a little closer to home, I thought. And then finally, this is where it really got me. And then he says, or it could have been the result of, and these are his exact words now, of deliberate action. And when I read those words, I thought, oh my word, he's talking about a war. He's talking about the Star Wars scenario, somebody pressing a button and kablooey, you take out a planet. And at that point, I thought, wow, because of course, in human traditions all over the world, you have this idea of a war of the gods. You have the Greek mythology with the Gigantomachy and that war. You have the war of the gods in the Vedic tradition in India. You have wars of the gods even in the Bible, if you want to look at it a certain way, the Archangel Michael versus Lucifer and the fallen angels. So you've got this tradition, that's kind of all over the world. So what I did in the book is I kind of started out with Van Flandern's exploded planet hypothesis, and then started to look at some of those ancient texts that, in my mind, are talking about that war and what may have happened, and you know who was doing what, and more importantly, why they were doing it.
Now, sticking on the scientific track for a bit, because it segues into what is going to come down the track, we kind of took a wrong turn with, let's say, for lack of a better term, Einsteinian physics. And you make a very cogent point in your writings about how Maxwell's original theorems were distorted, that there was actually something Maxwell came up with known as quaternium theory, because this dovetails directly with the plasma electric theory of the universe, and then from there, scalar vorticular energy fields, which dovetails directly into the phase conjugate weapon systems we're going to be talking about in a moment. Did you want to talk about that?
Well, quaternions are a form of mathematics that were invented by an Irish mathematician by the name of William Rowan Hamilton. They're very, very odd, but you're quite correct about Maxwell. When he formulated his unification of electricity and magnetism, which is, you know, it's a very important unification. It's kind of the first unified field theory when you get right down to it, to unify those two forces in a consistent set of equations. Well, he wrote those equations originally using Hamilton's quaternion mathematics. And this is so important, and it's so difficult to try and describe without the aid of a blackboard or a visual aid. So I want people to fasten on their imagination for a moment. When Maxwell's equations were edited by a British physicist by the name of Oliver Heaviside toward the late 19th century, what Heaviside did was he reformulated those equations in our modern linear algebra partial differential form. And in doing so, he left out or took out Maxwell's scalar potentials. All right, now, what's a scalar potential? If you look at modern physics, and particularly electromagnetic theory, they all use a vector algebra, and we all know what a vector is. If you simply draw an arrow on a piece of paper, that arrow represents a vector, a force that's moving or pushing, if you will, in a certain direction with a certain magnitude. Now, that is what physicists are taught is the kind of the basic model of modeling electromagnetic force. And that's the way that all of our current electromagnetic technology is based on that simple idea. Now, I want everybody to take their imagination or their imaginary piece of paper, and then we're going to draw two different systems of vectors. The first system, we're going to draw three arrows, and they're all three arrows are going to be of the same length, and they're going to converge at a point. They're going to be like an equilateral triangle, all right? So you're going to have three arrows converging at a point. And now we're going to draw a system of four arrows, same length, again, all converging at a point. And then you can go on and do this with five, six, seven, you know, you get the idea. In each of those systems, what you've constructed is what a mathematician or a physicist would call a zero-summed vector system. In other words, all the vectors of force cancel out at that point. And there's no translation vector. In other words, that point doesn't move. If there's an object sitting there, it's not going to move. It's just going to stay there because all the vectors of force are canceling each other out. All right. Now, it's precisely that which is the problem, because the modern vector algebra system says essentially that one zero-summed vector system is equivalent to another. They all sum to zero. So modern physicists don't even look at the structure of each of those systems, because if you look at what you've drawn on your paper, the internal structure of each system is very, very different. And what quaternion mathematics did, the kind of mathematics that Maxwell was using and what he was calling his scalar potential, was precisely these zero-sum vector systems. So if you look at the first system that you've drawn, you've got three vectors of force converging at a point. But that doesn't mean that there's no force there. That force is a pure magnitude, just kind of sitting there at that point. The same thing happens with the vectors of force in your four vector diagram. You've got four different forces all kind of piling up on each other, sitting there at that particular point. So there's actually energy there. It's just not doing anything that is observable. Follow me?
Yes.
And this is exactly what Maxwell did, and this is exactly what Heaviside threw out. So in other words, modern physicists, by dint of the kind of mathematics they use, are kind of trained to ignore something that could be very significant. And in my opinion, it is very significant, because that structure itself is kind of like a resonator, which if you can tap into the energy that's at that particular point, then you've got a tremendous amount of energy. So there's kind of an enfolded energy there that's just kind of waiting to be unpacked. And that's exactly what I think, quite frankly, is the basis of a lot of the Soviet era research. Colonel Tom Bearden has done a lot of research on that. Some of the Soviet scientists were looking at these kinds of structures, enfolded energetic structures that were embedded or imprinted on certain physical objects at a certain point. So yeah, that's the basis, that thinking is the basis for what people are calling scalar physics.
And this ties in directly, Doctor, with the model of the plasma electric universe, which in itself is kind of a modern version of what mystic seers and adepts for, you know, since time immemorial, referred to as the ether, the medium of the ether, because we see in the laboratory, in the plasma physics laboratory, it is scale invariant. We see things that happen in the laboratory on a small scale, which are replicated down to the most minute detail on a galactic, stellar, universal level.
Right. Yeah, that's a very important point about the scale invariance. There's a very famous plasma physicist I talk about in The Cosmic War by the name of Anthony Perrat. And Perrat noticed a very, very odd thing. That he and other plasma physicists, a famous Swedish physicist by the name of Hannes Alfvén, noticed the same thing back in the 40s. And they, on the basis of what they were noticing, began to construct a very different kind of cosmology than Einstein's general relativity. And you raised that point earlier, and I think it's very important that we understand what you're saying. Because Perrat noticed that under certain conditions, you could rotate plasmas and then take pictures of the plasma, and they would form these minute little structures that in many cases were almost identical to the structure of spiral galaxies. And, you know, once you start thinking in those terms, then yes, you're dealing with an electrical and plasma phenomenon that appears to be scale invariant, which that in itself is such an important conception, because in modern physics, of course, the problem has been to reconcile general relativity with quantum mechanics, you know, the physics of the very large and the physics of the very small. Well, what the plasma cosmologists were effectively trying to do was bypass that conundrum altogether by pointing out that there's a problem that's kind of squatting right in the middle of relativity, of general relativity, I should specify. And that problem is that information transfer cannot occur at speeds faster than light. Well, the problem with that is there does appear to be information transfer in the structure of a galaxy itself from one end of a galaxy to the other, because the galaxy, you know, is following an orderly plasma structure. Well, where is that structure coming from? There's got to be some sort of transfer of information to hold that structure together. And then the other problem is, of course, Einstein himself had this problem with quantum mechanics and basically set up the conditions of an experiment that led quantum mechanics physicists to pose the idea of entanglement. In other words, you can have things widely separated that are entangled systems, and if you alter something in one system, it immediately translates to the alteration of some other system at faster than light velocities. But again, the information isn't being translated. It's because the information was entangled to begin with, which brings us back to our scalar structures. If you look at those zero sum vector structures that you've drawn in your head, it will be apparent, I think, if you tie this idea with entanglement to a certain extent, that if you can replicate a structure at the other end of something that looks like a structure that you've drawn, that there might be a resonance effect established between the two that would be, again, kind of a kind of macro entanglement phenomenon, and therefore you could affect something at great distance almost immediately. Now, the other way that these scalar physicists oftentimes think in terms of these zero-sum vector structures is that those structures themselves are a longitudinal waveform of energy, waveform of compression and rarefaction. How am I to explain what's going on there when they say that? If you, and here I use the jump rope analogy, if you can imagine two people holding a jump rope between them, you know, they don't have it stretched tight or anything, they've just got this jump rope hanging between them, and one person at one end of the rope jerks it so that it sends a sine wave to the other person. Well, that sine wave is the typical way that electromagnetic energy is modeled. Our radio broadcast, our television broadcast, radar, and everything of this sort depends on this sine wave technology, and it's that which is moving at the speed of light. And you'll notice that when you jerk that wave, most of the energy that gets translated to the person holding the rope at the other end is lost in the up and down motion of the wave itself. Very little of the horizontal lateral energies getting transferred to that person. But a longitudinal wave is like a sound wave. It's like what you're hearing us talking right now. It's an area of compression and rarefaction in a medium. So now, if you want to understand scalar electrical thinking, what they're saying is that you have a kind of electrical version of a sound wave, an electroacoustical wave that's longitudinal. It's an area of compression and rarefaction in a medium. So the illustration to represent what they're talking about would be, instead of a jump rope between these two people, then suspend a yardstick between these two people, and then have one person on the end of the yardstick push it or pulse it. And what will happen is immediately all of that energy is received by the person at the other end in the form of those pulses. There's very, very little energy lost in the up and down motion of the sine wave. Most of it's coming through at the other end, and it's coming through much faster than the sine wave. So these people use that kind of an analogical thinking to point out that if they're dealing with electrical acoustic waves, then they might travel much faster than the velocity of light and therefore be responsible for these types of entanglement phenomena that we see.
And this speaks to the concept of action at a distance, where the speed of light is no longer a limiting factor. If one has the means to tickle the medium, tickle the ether, if you will.
Right.
Since it's scale invariant, everything has a natural resonance, which can be accessed and amplified. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. Exactly. And, you know, this is true. Every planet in the solar system, every planet everywhere has its own planetary resonance, a Schumann cavity resonance that the planet will vibrate at. It's the same thing with stars. You know, stars are broadcasting radio and all of this stuff all the time. You can actually go on YouTube and listen to some of these stellar broadcasts. So yeah, this we're talking right, we're right square back and with Pythagoras and the idea of the music of the spheres, the idea that there's an actual harmony that the ear cannot hear, that these bodies are sounding. So they viewed the universe in a certain sense as a great big musical instrument that was all entangled through the phenomenon of resonance. So yes, you're absolutely right.
Well, now that we've got the scientific background out there, for people to be able to wrap their minds around the next phase, what I'd like you to talk about, Doctor, is the wars that had gone on in the solar system and elsewhere. Because when I was growing up and I was reading Greek mythology and I was obsessed with Greek mythology, to me it had the ring of truth. To me, there was nothing fantastical about it. To me, it seemed like something that had really happened. And so I'd like you to talk about like the whys and the wherefores. Who were the main players? And if I understand it correctly, there were at least two phases of this war, and there were major players involved in each of the phases. Okay, could you elaborate on that?
Well, that I had the same experience with the Greek mythology and the Gigantomachy, the battle with the giants and so on that you did. I thought there's something going on here. This isn't just Greek science fiction that we're reading. Let's begin at a very interesting place, and that is the idea that ancient texts, and there's actually an academic term for this. In my books, I called it the unified intention of symbol. But there's actually an academic term for writing in the allegorical style, and that term is paronomasia. And basically, it means that you have to approach an ancient text like you would approach a Baroque fugue. It's written at a multiple at a multiplicity of levels, and each level is kind of acting independently of the others, but they all combine to paint one big picture. And in that sense, the names of the gods in a lot of these ancient texts, you have to remember that for them, the gods were the planets. They were the fates, the intelligences that we find associated with astrology back in ancient times. So in other words, the gods were planets. And once you wrap your head around that idea, then the other idea follows that the names of these gods are titular names for the overseer of a planet. And again, that's a very, very ancient doctrine. You find it even carried on in the Jewish tradition with the idea that various archangels are assigned to various planets, and their job is to make sure the planet functions smoothly. Okay. So I began with that idea, and it's interesting that in the Mesopotamian literature, if you start reading the Enuma Elish, which academics say is a creation epic, and I'm just absolutely 100% opposed to that nonsense, because if you sit down and read that text, it's a war epic. It's about a
Yes.
war. So in other words, academia is trying to program out of you the idea that you should look at this text any other way. Well, if you look at it as an account of a war, something very interesting emerges, because you've got this titanic struggle between Marduk and Tiamat and her allies, the other gods. So you're also dealing with kind of a civil war in the pantheon, exactly as you find in the Greek mythology with the Gigantomachy. You're dealing with kind of a civil war in the pantheon. And Tiamat is actually, I think, a kind of clever Babylonian code, if you will, for the exploded planet, because eventually Marduk destroys that planet, and you read the description of the way that Tiamat is destroyed. She begins to suffer earthquakes and so on and so forth until the text has it that Marduk drives in the final dart of wind, and kablooey, she blows up. So it's almost as if Marduk is pulsing Tiamat with energy that cannot be damped. And like blowing up a balloon, and then of course you get it to a certain pressure point, and then just prick it with a pin, kablooey, the balloon blows up. because there's all that stored energy. So that's kind of the description that you get in that text. And you turn to the Gigantomachy, and this again is very, very interesting because the war is between Kronos, which is the Greek term for Saturn, and Zeus. And Kronos, it's interesting to me that you go now out and you take pictures of Cassini of Iapetus or Iapetus, one of the moons of Saturn, and this thing looks for all the world like George Lucas's Death Star.
Yes, it does.
You know, it's uncanny, the resemblance between it. And you pile all this together, and what you have, James, in effect, is you've got a war that is a civil war among the gods. And in the Mesopotamian text, there's an interesting, to me, very modern sounding twist, because in the Mesopotamian text, the war is being fought over possession of the so-called tablets of destinies, which if you read those texts, it makes these tablets sound like they're the ultimate weapon of mass destruction, or at least can be used that way. And to me, that's very interesting because it's very modern sounding. Some of these gods want to possess these things. The other gods won't let them, and a war ensues. And they end up using the tablets of destinies as weapons in the war anyway. So, you know, it's kind of like the modern nightmare over nuclear proliferation. You know, we can't let certain countries have these terribly destructive weapons, and we're willing to go to war to prevent them. So we're, you know, we're reading a typically human thing here. You know, that's the other part of this that makes it sound, you know, legit to me. So yeah, these tablets of destinies were the ultimate weapons that they were fighting for possession of. And of course, in my reading of things, the war, basically both sides, it's kind of like a cosmic World War One. Both sides fight themselves to exhaustion. They end in kind of a stalemate. Everybody agrees, we're tired of this, let's go home. By the end of this war, I think both sides have pretty much blasted themselves and each other and their infrastructure to kingdom come. And, you know, the war just grinds to a halt because they've got to rebuild civilization. You know, they have nothing left to fight with. And that's what I think has happened.
You make a key point in your writings, Doctor, about this kind of analogy you drew of mountains equating the planets and having a connection to pyramids. And this was the crux of your trilogy, the Giza Death Star. And I encourage all my listeners to read it. It became an instant classic when it came out, because you talk about the pyramids being utilized as weapons of mass destruction, this phase conjugate mirror cavitating weapon that we spoke of earlier. And also, I'd like you to comment about the stones, the power crystals, because these power crystals seem to power up these pyramids and was the basis for their power system.
Yeah, actually, it's not pyramids in general. I'm maintaining that hypothesis. And you know, I'm the first to grant that it's a wild, woolly, out there, you know, hypothesis. But I maintain that hypothesis solely with respect to the Great Pyramid in Egypt. Because when you examine that structure, that is such an odd, unusual, overly engineered structure. I mean, it's just incredible the amount of stuff that was built into that thing. Let's talk, first of all, about the way that the pyramid was used. People, you know, I get the question all the time, well, how could you aim it? Well, this is not like a gun. You know, when I say howitzer, a phase conjugate howitzer, what I'm suggesting is that you don't point and aim it like you would an ordinary cannon or things like that. It's a weapon that functions entirely through resonance effects by establishing resonance with a target and then loading energy into it that it cannot damp. So how do you understand resonance? The easiest way to understand it is through the very simple phenomenon of the harmonic series in music. You sit down at an acoustic piano, you hold down a note, let's say a low note C, silently, and then you strike the same note an octave or two lower than that, and you will hear the note that you're holding down silently vibrating sympathetically with the note that you strike. So in other words, I think the Great Pyramid was constructed as kind of a universal harmonic oscillator. Think of it like a big grand piano that is open to other systems in local celestial space. Now, why do I say that? Because if you examine the structure of the Great Pyramid, it has embedded within it dimensional analogs of just gobs of stuff in local celestial space. You'll find embodied within it the circumference of the Earth. You'll find embodied within it the mean temperature of the Earth. You'll find the speed of light embodied in it in the form of the distance from the Earth to the Sun, and on and on and on and on this goes.
It even has pi factored into it, doesn't it?
It has pi factored into it. In my thinking, there may be indications that it even has the coefficients of some of the constants of quantum mechanics embodied in it, you know. And if that proves to be the case, no one has sat down to do a statistical analysis, so it's kind of a qualitative hypothesis at this juncture. But if that should prove to be the case, then, you know, by golly, somebody way back when was building a structure that knew all about some of the constants of quantum mechanics, you know, which throws the history of things into kind of a cocked hat. But the structure itself is built with all of these redundant dimensional analogs of local celestial space. And that would be what you would do if you were to attempt to build an oscillator, a coupled harmonic oscillator, with local celestial space. You're literally building an object that is resonant to any configuration of the planets and so on and so forth. Now, the crystals, this is where it gets very, very interesting. The crystals that you referred to, I believe, were located in the Grand Gallery. And I got onto this idea after reading Chris Dunn's book, yes, called The Giza Power Plant. An excellent book. If you don't know the book, folks, go out and buy that book. Because Dunn hypothesizes that in the Grand Gallery, you've got those 27 slots on the ledge on either side of the Grand Gallery. And he points out that the Grand Gallery itself is constructed like a big, huge acoustic resonating chamber. So he postulates that these slots held banks of Helmholtz resonators, which are kind of a circular form of an organ pipe on a pipe organ. And, you know, that kind of intrigues me because I grew up playing pipe organs. If you can imagine the interior of the Grand Gallery filled with all these resonators, then yeah, you've got, again, the idea that this structure was built to be in acoustic harmonic resonance with something. And the question is why? Now, I took a step further because when I read Zechariah Sitchin's Wars of Gods and Men, to me, a very frustrating book because he comes up with all these insights and then he doesn't follow them through. But one of the things that he hypothesized, just like Dunn, and the two didn't know each other when they were writing what they wrote, he also speculated that there was something that had been in the Grand Gallery that went missing, and that these things were crystals of some sort. And I began to experiment with the idea, well, maybe they were crystalline resonators, following Dunn's suggestion, and that they had very unique lattice refractive properties that could actually capture photonic energy in a kind of vorticular lattice structure. And, you know, lo and behold, years later, you know, you read on science papers that scientists are working with kind of that very idea, you know, which I didn't know at the time that they were. But so you add all this together, and what you're dealing with is a very, very sophisticated machine that is designed to manipulate energy, where the only point that I part company with Chris Dunn is precisely at the point that all of the dimensional analogs of the structure, which do not figure into his hypothesis or his thinking do figure into mine, because why would you need to build a power plant with all of these dimensional analogs of the structure of local space-time if you were not intending to manipulate that structure?
Yes.
So in other words, at that point, you know, we cross the line from power plant into weapon. And, you know, you can configure that for a variety of uses, but basically you're using the phenomenon of resonance, I think, to target places in local celestial space. And, you know, that can be right here on planet Earth.